Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from History International, circling the globe with the series The Naked Archaeologist to solve 2,000-year-old mysteries. Wednesdays at 8 Eastern on History International.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Thank you. Well, it's great to be back here in the Old South Meeting House. I told Paul he needed to have some war paint to get ready for the ritual trip. Actually, the revolution that Paul is talking about is being televised from a million different monitors and sources around the world. And as you will hear, it is indeed a revolution. But let me not tell his story, but tell you a little bit about him. So, if you were in the Boston area back in the 60s, and you had a hankering for something a little organic, you might have made your way over to this little known as Erewhon. Anyone here remember Erewhon? All right. And how many of you remember it was Paul Hawkins' store? All right. And so, having gotten his feet into wonderfully, appropriately driven, impossible to please everybody enterprises, he was set for life. And the next thing that you might have seen commercially from him was Smith & Hawken, the garden tool company. Now, Paul's a guy who grew up around a library and spent a lot of time reading and thinking and being out there in Berkeley. And when it came to his attention that, in fact, you couldn't get a decent garden tool in America, he decided to do this. The trouble was it entailed starting a business. But the good news about starting the business, not only did we get Smith & Hawken, but we got a book called Growing Your Own Business and how to fertilize and keep it watered and get it sprouting and all those things. And it was a PBS series as well, way back when. So, you know, most people would have been satisfied with that, right? Start a grocery chain that ultimately is morphed into what? The Whole Foods empire. Do a garden supply company that has, you know, just changed the way that we're out doing stuff? No, but Paul was just getting started. And that's when he sat down and eventually out came the book, The Ecology of Commerce, when he started talking about the circularity instead of the linear way that people are doing business. And then for people, and after raising all those questions, people wanted to say, well, how the heck do you do this? How do you have an ecological business? So he got himself an oxygen mask, because he had to go up to Snowmass, Colorado, up into the Rockies, with Amory and Hunter Lovins to write this thing. And I don't know, have you seen Natural Capitalism? I mean, this book is like, I mean, this is really thick. I mean, there's every single detail you need to know in that to do an ecologically competent business or enterprise. Everything, at least at the time, of course. Things do change. But that wasn't enough. Paul, ever the restless spirit, decided to dig deeper. And he started counting non-governmental organizations. And I think at this point I should let him pick up the story. The thing about Paul Hawken is that not only is he an amazing thinker, he's a very powerful doer. When he gets a notion, he has to go out and run with it, and run with it hard. So I want you to strap yourself in. You're going to need your seatbelt for this ride. It's never comfortable at the beginning of a revolution. And he's about to tell you about one, and well, he's got a bunch of other stories, too. So without further ado, Paul Hawken.
Thank you, Steve. I could tell some great stories about Steve as well. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for allowing me to speak in this truly august place. I have to tell you a story about Erewhon, which is that when it first began, we began importing tea from Japan called kukicha, which is twig tea. And that's what kukicha means, twig tea. And the FDA in Boston seized the tea under the 1872 Tea Inspection Act because it had too many twigs in it. And we went back and forth and tried to prevent its seizure, but eventually, and I'm not kidding, they dumped it into Boston Harbor. So we thought about that. And so then we bought rice bowls in Japan, and we packed them in the kukicha. So we labeled it rice bowls, and they opened it up and saw the rice bowls and put the lid back on and shipped it, let it go. So it was no longer food, it was ceramics, and then we sold the tea and took the rice bowls home. So anyway, I wanted to just recount that story since we're here at the beginning of the tea party. I want to talk about a movement that has no name, that really, for all intents and purposes, does not exist in the conventional sense of the word. And I think what I'm overall suggesting to you tonight is that change never happens from the vectors we expect them from, that we do not change history, that history changes us, and that the culture as a whole, including me most of the time, is generally looking in the wrong direction for positive signs of change. And as Steve said, this began as a count. It began as curiosity. In the 1990s, after I had published The College of Commerce, I began to give talks in this country, in Asia, in Europe, and Australia, New Zealand. And after those talks, I would meet people, people with their cards. And since I had been on the board of Audubon and Conservation International and Trust for Public Land, I had sort of a bird's eye view, I thought, of what the environmental movement was in this country, a sense of the landscape. But repeatedly, as I received people's cards, I read names of organizations that I had never heard of again and again and again. Well, I would put them in various pockets in my backpack and then take them home, and then after a week or so on the road, sort of put everything out. This went to the laundry, this is my cards. And then I would read them all on the table in my houseboat in Sausalito, and then I would put them in a kitchen drawer. So far, so good. When I bought the houseboat, I bought a housekeeper with it. She was 75. She actually couldn't clean. She was too old to clean at that time. But the tradition in the dock was that you hired her because she didn't have Social Security, so that we were her Social Security, and you could tell she had been at the house because it was completely rearranged. She was an artist. It looked quite nice, but nothing was clean, so I hired a cleaner on the side. And one day I came home, and she had taken the cards from the drawer, and she had placed them in a Gold Lame Bergdorf Goodman bag, shopping bag, with white sort of rope tasseled handles, and put it in my closet where I got dressed every morning. And there they were, and so I got to see them every day, and as the days and weeks and months went by, cards kept going into this bag until one day the bag was full, and that is the origin of this book, literally, which is, I looked at that bag and said, wait a minute, you know, how many organizations are there out there working on behalf of the environment? At about that time, I began to really redefine, however, this thing called the environmental movement. And for me, it included the social justice movement. And it included it for a very simple and obvious reason, is that both types of organizations, although they may be very specific in terms of what they were applying themselves to with respect to some insult or a person or place, the fact of the matter is they were dealing with the same economic political system, which was stealing the future and selling it in the present in the form of GDP or net profit for a corporation. Now, whether the theft was in the form of a clear-cut forest in British Columbia or in the form of child labor at a chocolate plantation or in the form of toxic workers in a Chinese factory making things for big box retailers in the United States, it didn't make any difference at all. The fact is that there is a violation of people in place in order to benefit and profit in the present time. And the fact that organizations had directed themselves to different aspects of it, to me, was irrelevant to the idea, the concept, that in fact they were part of one larger movement. Because even though they may be dealing with specific symptoms, They were all dealing with one system. And as I did that, the cards changed, they increased, my talks changed, my audiences changed, and I began to then do a harder count. And as Steve said, I am a Berkeley grad. I grew up there. My father taught at the library. I went from school to the library, and I used to crawl around in the stacks and go up to any floor, go down an aisle, sit down on the metal floors, and pick books out by the spine and open them up and read randomly. And so there was a sense I had, being the son of a librarian, if you will, that you could find anything you wanted to find if you just searched well enough. So I began to try to find out how many organizations there were in the world that were involved with the environment and social justice. And as I researched more, I had a difficult time in finding them. And I found directories, I found lists. I'm not going to start quite yet, Alex, but thank you. But I found lists, I found tax records to be sure, but in fact I found nothing that approximated what I was seeing out there. But I did extrapolate, start to work with things, and I noticed the list got to 30,000, 40,000, 70,000, 100,000 organizations. And at that point, at 100,000, then I began to look at, well, the history of social movements themselves. Which social movement here or anyplace else approximated 100,000 in terms of the number of organizations? And I couldn't find one. So I began to surmise that maybe this was the largest social movement in the world. And on it went. And as I did that, I then began to look at the history. Where did it come from? Because it'd be easy to say, if you will, that it started in the 70s with Earth Day, or go back to Rachel Carson, or go back to the Civil Rights Movement, or go back to the 30s, or you can trace it back to the populist movements, to women's suffrage, etc. I mean, you can go back and definitely find the roots of this. We have, in this country, the greatest history of social movements in the world, but you would never know it reading the history books they give to our kids. But this is the birth, really, of the most innovative social movements in the world, this country, United States. But as I pulled the string, I particularly got fascinated by the transcendentalists, and we're a good place to talk about them here. And particularly because when I went to high school, I had a really hard time with the transcendentalists, and I had a very hard time because the teacher, Mrs. Smith, now you know Smith and Hawken, Mrs. Smith was a undercover Berkeley policewoman, and she didn't realize that everybody in the school knew that except her. And I took it upon myself to make it known that an undercover policewoman could not teach transcendentalism at Berkeley High. And she made it well known that she was in charge, and I was suspended twice. And finally one day the dean came in, rather ashen-faced, and said that Mrs. Smith had died in the faculty lounge, and I raised my hand in my best Oscar Wilde imitation and said, "How could you tell?" And he was furious, probably traumatized by what was going on in the faculty lounge to begin with. And sort of yanked me and dragged me, literally, out of the schoolroom into his office and suspended me, but once again, and said that I could not return to school unless I wrote an essay on rebellious youth. Exactly. Which I refused to do. And was expelled, which... it's a whole nother story, because it went rapidly downhill after that. But in revisiting the transcendentalists to research this book, I realized that the essays that they did let us read, you know, like Prudence, was really sort of like a Calvinist America trying to, you know, grope with this Unitarian minister, you know, and others who were really out there. And I don't know, and I say this in... figuratively speaking, of course, what they were smoking, but there simply is no way that a 17-year-old lad can really incorporate what those guys and women were talking about. I'm sorry, it's just you don't have the life experience, you know. Not that it shouldn't be read then, but it should be reread much later and absorbed. And in reading about the Transcendentalists, one of the fascinating stories that came up for me was really starts in 1832, right here when Emerson's wife had died, and he went to Europe, the pilgrimage, if you will, Coleridge and Wordsworth and other friends of his. But he ended up, after landing in Malta and going up the Boot of Italy, and ended up in Paris at the Jardin des Plantes and the Cabinet of Natural History, where he met the Jussieu family. And the Jussieu family were quite well-known botanists and taxonomists who had created a marvelous, marvelous botanical garden and displays of flora and fauna at the Cabinet of Natural History. And if you read his journals that night, it was clear that Emerson had truly a rhapsodic experience, really the first sort of time of elation since his wife's death. And what he saw there, because of the way they displayed the flora and fauna, is in color and form and morphology, is that he could really see the web of life. He could see, in a sense, evolution, although there was no term for either at that time. And in his journals that night, he's waxing on about nature, that we are nature, that our mind is nature. What is then the opposite? What is the nature of the mind? What is the nature of governance? What is the nature of religion? In other words, he is just consumed all of a sudden by the connectivity of all things, and then how does it all make sense? And as we know, he came back and wrote Nature, his first book, and one of the very first readers of that book was Harvard's first hippie, Henry David Thoreau, right? And avidly bought it, read it again in his senior year, that was his senior year, read it again a few months later. Emerson addressed the senior class that year. Later, he was invited to Emerson's house in Cambridge, and he asked him, having spent 4 years at Harvard and having no job skills, he said, "What should I do?" And Emerson said, "Keep a journal," which he did from that day for 7,000 some odd pages until he died. And what is important about that is that 12 years later, as we well know, is that Thoreau was arrested on his way to get his shoes, pick up his shoes by Sam Staples for not paying his poll tax. Now, what isn't often written about is that that year he was particularly peeved because a sitting president had been elected knowing before he was elected that he was going to go to war. Sound familiar? But this was Polk, and this was the Mexican War, right? And the history of that is really truly outrageous. Won't go into that. But it added fuel to the fire of objecting to a poll tax that prohibited African Americans and others from voting. And he was spent a night in jail. He had hot chocolate. His sister bailed him out. We don't actually know which day he was in jail, actually. July 25, 26, 27, somewhere around there. But 18 months later, at the Concord Lyceum, he gave a talk. Later was published as an essay on resistance to civil government. And when he died in 1862, it was still known as resistance to civil government. And 4 years later, it was republished in Yankee in Canada by Houghton Mifflin, as I believe, as civil disobedience. Well, why is that important? Well, the first thing that's important about it is that he never used that phrase or word in any of his writings. In other words, Thoreau never used that term. Second of all, it became a very, very important sort of phrase for that from that time on, because 40 years almost to the day after that, there was a meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa, facilitated by a young solicitor named Mohandas K. Gandhi. And in that meeting, 1,100 Muslims and Hindus had decided to be arrested instead of register according to the Black Act, the Asiatic Registration Act. And in his journal that night, Gandhi was quite disturbed in some ways by what they had and he had agreed to do, because he wasn't sure of the implications to him and others, especially a young solicitor of color in South Africa. And somebody from the Indian Times, who we do not know, gave him Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, and it had a remarkable effect on both his thinking and his demeanor. He was arrested shortly thereafter. He waved it to the press as he went to jail along with Ruskin and said, I'm going to study up more on this while I'm in jail. But what Thoreau did, if you think about it, is really make going to jail cool. Because there was a stigma up until then. And what he said in that essay is the government is unjust, the just man is in jail. And the apocryphal story of Emerson coming to him and saying, Henry, what are you doing in there? And him saying, Waldo, what are you doing out there? Although not true, is really true in a deeper way, which is that Emerson was upset because of the stigma of going to jail. And Thoreau, however, does what young people do so well, and that is take their teachers at their word. And Emerson was saying that it was all connected, which means that if he paid his tax for Texas Rangers to rape Mexican women for a illegal war, then he was raping those women and he wouldn't pay his tax, right? So almost 50 years after Gandhi goes to jail, Rosa Parks is standing at the bus stop, December 1st, 1955. And again, what we don't hear was who she saw when she opened the door, when the door opened. And it was James Blake. Well, who's James Blake? The bus driver. James Blake was the person who physically manhandled and threw her off the bus 12 years before. And anybody who's been subject to physical violence knows the fight or flight reaction and response that you'll have if you see your attacker again. Even if they can't see you, your whole body will go into shock. And it did. And she looked in the eye of her oppressor, and she got on the bus. Right? That was probably the most difficult thing she did that night. Not getting up after that was probably a piece of cake compared to getting on the bus itself. Well, why did she do it? Why? Well, she was sent to the Highlander School that summer to study civil disobedience taught by Miles Horton, who was influenced by Mohandas Gandhi, and sent there by Virginia and Clifford Durr. Virginia Durr was traveling around that year and before with Mary Bethune to fight the poll tax, which was still in place in America at that time. Right? And what we know is that 5 days after she was arrested, they then elected this wonderful, young, eloquent minister named Martin Luther King to be the head of the Montgomery Improvement Association to lead the bus boycott, and within 2 months, his house was blown up, the front of it, with dynamite, while Coretta and his two children were there. And there almost ensued a riot. He quelled it. They sent Bayard Rustin down from New York to talk to this emerging civil rights leader. He went to the King home. He sat down. The first time he sat down, he reached under the cushion and pulled out a loaded gun and put the gun down, moved over to another chair, and then there was another gun. And the whole house was an arsenal. And Rustin said, I thought this was a nonviolent movement. And King says, it is, but nobody better come in who's not invited. And King said, no, he said, nonviolence is really a principle. Have you read the writings of Gandhi? And he said, no, but I've heard of him. He said, so he sent Glenn Smiley over the next week to bring the autobiography by Gandhi and Civil Disobedience by Thoreau. Okay. Now, what is so important about this story is not Emerson, Thoreau, Gandhi, King, Parks. Those people would have been magnificent, courageous leaders, no matter what happened, I think. What is important about this story is the people we don't hear about, the Jussieu family in Paris, whose taxonomy was used by Wallace and Darwin and expropriated quite freely with no accreditation. Okay, but that's another story. The French rarely get credit. Okay. What's important is, who is this person who renamed the essay? We do not know who did it. We have theories, but nobody knows. No scholar knows to this day, right? Who was the person at the Indian Times who gave the essay to Gandhi? Who is this person? Who had read it? Who knew about it? Who gave it to him? Right? We do not know that person's name either. Do we know who Joanne Robinson is? The person who started the Montgomery Improvement Association? there is a leader for you, but we don't hear much about her. She started 2 years before the Rosa Parks arrest, right? And the Durer, the Clifford and Virginia Durer, and I could go on. What I'm saying here is that when you look at these historical string of events, what you find is these small, seemingly inconsequential actions that people undertook because of their conscience, because of their intention, because of their care, had a decisive and amazing effect on history that followed. And when you look back and look out now and look forward to the history we face, when you look at the myriad problems that this world confronts, when you imagine the data that's coming from scientists with respect to climate change, the loss of fisheries, the death of our oceans, the peak soil, not just peak oil, peak water, not just peak oil, peak a lot of things, and you look at that, and it's easy to go into despair, to start to think that, what can I do? And I want to ask you tonight to do one thing, which is to completely give up the idea that you have any control over the future. You have none. But you can control one thing, and that is your intention. It's the intention that you can hold. This is a very Buddhist statement, really. But intention. Intention. Thank you for paying attention. But your intention is something that is steady, clear, deep, grounded. And now you can sing and dance because really we have no control over outcomes whatsoever. And again, as you read history over and over again, you find that it was these small things. And we don't know tonight, tomorrow, an hour ago, the small things we have done, the things we might have said, the book we might have given to someone else, the invitation we might have extended. Who knows? We have the St. Bonnie School here from New Hampshire. Which one of these students or more will do something that is really unforeseen and superb and fantastic in the future because one teacher took the time to do something? That is really the way the world works. And we tend to focus on the big things and look back as if they were predictable and as if we could have known them, but we're just making that stuff up. We do not know what will come. And having said that, what I'm suggesting in Blessed Unrest is that we're looking in all the wrong places for love. In other words, we still look for the white or otherwise charismatic male vertebrate to show up and lead us, okay? And I want to say he ain't coming, all right? And thank God, finally a movement that's not led by a white charismatic male vertebrate. There is this movement in the world that's led by tens of thousands of people, right? Of every culture, every race, every language, in every city, in every country, right? And we don't see it because our media, our TV, our schools, our education is still pointing us to isms. There is an ism out there. There's an ideology out there. There may be a political party. Maybe there's a new candidate. Just maybe a religious leader. Please, won't somebody show up? And if we look the other direction, humanity is showing up. Right? In an astonishing way. So what I'd like to do is give you a sense of the scale of this movement, and this is the best way to do it. And Alex is going to gin it up and see if it works. And this is a little bit of a kludge here. My book is supporting the projector, my computer. You just have to take the cap off, that's all. Yeah, that'll help. And just move the projector slightly, right? But what I, and hit the space bar again. There you go. But these are just names of organizations, cities, and countries. And most of them you haven't heard of or seen before. Maybe you might have heard of one or two of them. That's done easily and on purpose. These are from our database, wiserearth.org, which I welcome you to visit and go to. But in order to get a sense of the scope, the breadth, but more importantly, in this clip, the size of this, imagine that we start playing this now, which is really like credits, right? And just about you can read it. You have to really pay attention to read everyone, and you can't listen to me too much. Starting now, we would have to watch this all night tonight, and we'd be here all day tomorrow. And we would be here all night tomorrow night, and all day Thursday, and all night Thursday night, we'd still be looking at the names, and all night Thursday night, all day Friday, and Friday night. We would be here Saturday and Saturday night, 24 hours, Sunday, Sunday night. We'd still be here Monday morning. All the commuters come back to work. We'd still be here Monday night. We would have been here for a week. And after we had been here for a week, we would stay another week. Then another week after that. And one more week after that. In other words, we would sit here 24 hours a day for a month before we would have seen all the names of the organizations in the world that are working to restore the environment and to address social justice and human rights. That's how big it is. Now I'm going to save you the trouble and speed it up so you can go home tonight. There they go. Okay. Now, when I discovered, if you will, and this is between one and two million groups right now that we know exist, and there may be more. It is not only the largest movement in the world, the largest movement in history, it is the fastest growing. And I looked in the literature for language that described it. And I looked and read about other social movements, but the language, although interesting, seemed lacking in many ways. And so I turned to biological metaphors. And the metaphor that I liked the most is that what I think we're seeing is humanity's immune response to political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation. And an immune system is an amazing thing. It is, first of all, the most complex system in the human body, more complex than any organ, more complex than your brain by far. And it is very ancient and very old. The immune system does not work as Donald Rumsfeld's Department of Defense, just shooting strange pathogens that come its way. It works very differently. It works more like a chamber of commerce mixer, everybody talking to each other, hi, I do ice wands for weddings, what do you do? I mean, in other words, all these molecules are trying to figure out what's going on. There's a high degree of connectivity in an immune system. And the immune system actually tries rapprochement or détente before it tries to kill something. And it has an amazing library, better than anything we know of at Harvard and University of California, Berkeley. It takes little bits and pieces of pathogens, even the whole pathogen, will stick them on these follicular dendritic cells, live and dead, and just keep them there, and little peanuts of your lymph nodes scattered around your body just to have this sort of Alexandrian immunological library carrying around so that it knows what it encounters in the world as you breathe and eat and drink water and put your finger in your mouth. It is an amazing thing. But what we know about the internet is that what makes it more effective is better connectivity. The better connected it is, the more resilient it is in terms of invasive pathogens. But what's so interesting about that, the analog, the thing that we have in human society that is the closest to the immune system that we have created is the internet. But the internet, with its 1 quintillion transistors and its 1 million emails per second, is much, much smaller than the functioning and activities of the immune system of one human being. Okay? Of one human being. Inside your body are 100 trillion cells. There's 900 trillion other cells that are non-human. Interesting relationship there, right? You have a quadrillion cells within one cell. There's 400 animals, human cell, there's 400 billion molecules. There's 10 millions of activities going on in one cell at one time. In your body, right this second, right now, there's one set to one octillion activities going on. That's 10 to 100 times more than all the stars in the 15 million light year wide universe going on right now in your body. And I have two questions for you. And the first question is, can you feel it? It's a lot of activity. Seriously, can you feel it? And if I may say so, the answer is absolutely, you can feel it. You felt it since you were born and before. You felt it always, so we don't know what to call it, except it's called life, and you're feeling it right this second. It just permeates your whole being and body. And my second question for you is, who's in charge? Who's managing this activity? Right? Hopefully not the Republican Party. But if anybody tried to manage it, you would die. In other words, it is a community of communities of communities of communities. It is extraordinary, and we do not understand really how it functions and how it works. This movement with the million organizations, with 100 million people, also does not have a management system. It is not managed. We don't recognize it as a movement because it doesn't have one leader. There's no centrality. There's no ideology. We have this picture, this frame of what it is that we should be looking for, and it's coming from the other direction. Right? It is an extraordinary thing that's occurring. I want to show you one more clip, and this one goes sideways instead of up and down. And this emerged from us cataloging these organizations in wiserearth.org. And WISER stands for World Index of Social and Environmental Responsibility, by the way. So that's what WISER, the acronym, stands for. And what you're seeing and what you will see here is what we call areas of focus. In other words, when we say environment or social justice, what do we mean? Well, we decided not to decide that, but is to look at these organizations one by one by one and have them tell us what it is that they do. What is their area of focus? And usually they have more than one, so not just one. And we came up with 414 categories, 20,000 keywords, tags, if you will, and definitions, and that is on the back of the book. And what you see here, to me, and this is my opinion now, is the curriculum for the 21st century. And it's really what humanity is arising to deal with. It is taking on the salient issues that government and corporations, frankly, are failing at, which is water, education, poverty, health, climate. You go right on down the list. Right? I'm not saying all businesses are failing or all governments are failing. I'm simply saying that these issues, which we've known about for a long, long time, you know, are getting away from us. And people are rising up to do what they can in place with the tools they have, with the capability they have, and with the resources they have. Is being, I think, created from the bottom up because, frankly, it is largely corrupt from the top down. And the bottom-up solutions are gratefully seated on both sides of you tonight. There are our neighbors, there are friends, there are communities. There are values that we have held for hundreds and thousands of years. This isn't a new movement. It goes back to the Transcendentalists, but it goes back to the abolitionists, to Clarkson and to Wilberforce in 1787 in London, who really created the framework and the meme for the first NGO in the world. It was the first time citizens had gotten together to organize themselves on behalf of people they would not know, would never know, and from which they would never derive indirect or direct benefit. And they were called liberals, progressives, do-gooders, activists. They were mocked. They were made fun of. There was 3 out of 4 people at that time were indentured or enslaved. They said they would destroy the British economy, etc. Well, so much for the opinions of conservatives. Right? I mean, this is what always has been said to human beings when they organize around values which we truly hold in common. And what we're talking about here really is a world of growth without inequality, a wealth without plunder, work without exploitation, a future without fear. And these values go way back in our history, back to the Axial Age. There's a great book by Karen Armstrong, The Great Transformation, talks about the Axial Age, the birth of religiosity, not religion, religiosity, but Socrates, Buddha, Mencius, Lao Tzu, Jeremiah, Isaiah. And when you read her work, what you realize at that time, 3 things really happened. One is these sages and philosophers and prophets really were producing social movements. This was about improving the lives of human beings. This was a time of great cruelty, great barbarity and violence in the world. And people stood up and arose and turned away from it. You know. And these people were not teaching monotheistic religions or building temples, anything like that. They were talking about what does it mean to lead a moral and ethical life. And the question I think all of us ask and these organizations ask is the same thing, which is, given where we are at this time in the 21st century, what is an ethical act? What is a moral act? What is a meaningful business? What is a meaningful role to play in governance, in education, in religion, etc.? And out of that time came things which we know so well now, but 2 things. One is the Golden Rule. It arose simultaneously from Asia right across to the Middle East into Greece, which is never, ever do anything to anyone you would not have done to yourself. And the second was that all life is sacred, whether it's a child or a creature or a culture. And those values which we began instilled at that time, to me, are the underlying values of this movement. And it is a movement because if you ask these organizations what their principles are, what their values are, what it is that they are dedicated to, and you write it down and you put it on a wall one by one by one, and you go down this endless wall and you read it, you will find that they're all different. And none of them contradict themselves. This is the first time such a movement has ever happened in the history of humanity. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. You have such an amazing vision, and to hear this analogy, or maybe it's not even an analogy, maybe this is in fact the way it works, the immune system. I always marvel at how nature imitates itself in different sizes. The solar system looks like an atom and all that. And so maybe we as a species, and I know in your book you talk about the Gaia hypothesis, maybe actually we're just all part of one organism here. Is that true?
Well, I mean, Spinoza and Teilhard de Chardin and Lewis Thomas, the great essayist and medical doctor, have all, and many others, have surmised that we collectively organize ourselves and do things that cannot be explained by individuation or ideation, that there's something going on in humanity that is like a supra-consciousness or a supra-awareness, and that it has a scientific basis, not just a religious or spiritual basis. But whether that's true or not, to me, the immune system is the most effective metaphor to describe the congruence and the confluence, really, of these organizations around the world. You can easily criticize them because they're just human beings and they have clay feet and they screw up and sometimes are competitive and have sharp elbows and are jealous. And just they're just people. They're not better people. They're just people than all the other people. But what unites them or what brings them together is this sort of courage and this fierceness and this willingness, in a sense, to forsake maybe career or security or the normal trappings that are proffered by, you know, middle class or upper middle class existence, and instead dedicate their lives to the welfare and the well-being of people that they will probably never meet. It is the kindness of strangers in an extraordinary way.
Well, we'll take some questions in a moment, but just to go down the path of the immune system analogy, so where are we? I mean, immune systems get assaulted by disease and disorder, and they either sort of instantly shrug them off and the body never hears about it, or ever so often, quite a bit of disease sets in. And then, on a good day, the immune system somehow at the last minute snaps back and starts to fight. And on a bad day, well, you know what happens then.
Well, interestingly, when I first used the metaphor, I plunged into the literature, and immunist means ready to serve, which I thought was a kind of a nice thing. If anything's ready to serve, it's this movement. But when you read the writings of people like Gerald Callahan or others who are immunologists, and they will say that when you get into that death spiral, when you are very sick and then so sick that, in a sense, you start to get sicker, that is, you become a prey to other organisms, and you get worse and your fever gets higher, and etc., that there is a point, and many of us have felt it in one way or another in our worst flu or some condition that we've had, tropical disease or something, where we really feel like we're going to die or in some cases want to die. We feel so bad. And there is this moment when you can feel the immune system change. What's important about that is that the immunologist will say, we don't really understand what happens at that point. Because essentially, things are winding down, they're not winding up. We're losing resilience. Some of those little diseases that were stored on dendritic cells are being released as live pathogens into the body. In other words, it is a death spiral. And that moment is, I mean, doctors can't say this, but is a kind of a small and unknown miracle, and better than any Hollywood thriller. And I don't proffer this just because we're in a similar situation on Earth. I think we are. But in the sense of you simply can't predict things in a linear fashion when it's a living organism.
Well, since we're in a lot of trouble, we need that reaction now, quick, huh?
Well, the thing about the immune system is that it follows the disease. If it leads the disease, or in real time, it's called autoimmune, and that kills you too. So what happens is that people who are in the movement, many friends feel that it's getting worse faster than it's getting better, so therefore the movement is failing, which is true. I mean, but it is the nature of an immune response to be very careful and to lag the disease, and as opposed to lead the disease. And again, if we'll see whether that metaphor holds up by the end of the 21st century and we look back.
Okay. So now it's your chance to join the discussion. We have some microphones here at the front. Anything from Emerson to Spinoza to Hawken? While she comes to the microphone, are you ready? And if you wouldn't mind just giving your full name, please.
Cynthia Bowman. And when you say all life is sacred, does that put you in the pro-life camp?
Absolutely. Nobody's more pro-life than I am. I'm pro-all life. But if you're talking about the woman's right to choose, so that's a woman's right, not a man's right.
My name is Terry Mason. I'm not sure I'm going to stick with your analogy. I'm trying to decide where governments fit into, you know, this immune system structure that you've got going. We've got civil society. Where are the governments in that?
Well, they're here. And their effectiveness, to me, is inversely correlated to their scale. So what you're seeing is, and by the way, Wiser Earth is creating a wiserbusiness.org and then wiser.gov, because you need all three legs of this stool in order to make a sustainable community or region or state or anything else. But what you're seeing right now is amazing initiatives on the local community and civic level in this country and in many, many other countries. I was just in Seattle talking to a very well-known NGO, and they were saying that the mayor was so out there in terms of the initiatives, Greg Nichols, that he was announcing and promoting, that they weren't sure that there was any reason for them to continue existence, right? And that is a wonderful, wonderful thing to hear, actually, from an NGO, that that is the reason there's so many non-governmental organizations, is because actually government has not shown up for a long time. The real non-governmental organization is in Washington, D.C., right? I mean, we lost governance a long time ago. And so in a way, what we're seeing is surrogate organizations arise to fill in functions which we, as a citizen, have traditionally basically relegated to governance, and properly so. But that demands a governing system that responds to people and not to money. So what I do see in this country, and I say elsewhere, is very responsive civic and local governments really trying to reimagine their role, how to be more sustainable, how to address poverty in a more systemic way as opposed to a palliative way, and how to really integrate people's living conditions, social conditions, with the fact that we're trashing the environment at the same time, and using the metaphor, if you'll, of restoration as a way to both restore people, place, culture at the same time through green jobs and other means.
All right.
Hi, my name is Shoshana Friedman. Thank you so much for being here. I was wondering if you could speak to the degree to which you saw interconnectedness between the organizations as you were looking at them, coalitions, or the awareness, speaking from someone who's within a nonprofit now, the awareness of one organization of this movement and where you see maybe this lecture series fitting into that. Because I see that being one cell in the part of a system, you derive a lot of strength just from hearing somebody reaffirm that you are part of something bigger. And I feel like a lot of what we're struggling with as nonprofit workers is this sense of an ineffectiveness as a whole.
Yes, I quite agree with you. And I mean, I would say that I say this as with profound respect, but I think what the movement suffers from is kind of low self-esteem. And that low self-esteem comes in part from working so hard and so diligently for so long, and seeing one's efforts just trounced, if you will, by a piece of legislation, a presidential writ given that Friday at 5 o'clock, you know, or just the covert exercise of power, you know, trumping the overt exercise of aspiration. And it's funny, because when I was saying this to Steve earlier, but when I was a parent, I still am, but I mean, when my kids were small, I used to read the book, which they loved, I didn't, but because you read it once, it's enough, but Are You My Mother? And about this little duckling that's going around, was it Boston? I think, I don't know, it was some city, but going around looking at steam shovels and cars and policemen and asking, Are you my mother? And how disconsolate and sad it was. And finally it found its mother, and how joyous it was. And I think this movement has a mother too. Everything has a mother. And part of the reason that the clip and Wiser Earth and the book and a movie to come is really to hold a mirror up to this movement so that it can see itself and say, look, you're not alone. You don't have to do everything. What you do may in itself falter. It may not succeed. But even if it doesn't, it will in some greater aggregate way that, you know, that we cannot understand. And what I feel is happening is that the, you know, cell phones and texting and internet particularly are producing and creating a kind of connectivity and a hooking up and a coalescence and a collaboration that is still nascent and developing, but is really spreading very rapidly and causing two things. One, much better, as I said, collaboration, but also a rapid growth of the movement itself. Again, in Seattle, I spoke to a woman who took a class with me years ago. She became an activist. She then took a job in Seattle on sustainability. Now, half her salary is being paid for by the city of Seattle. Half her salary is being paid for by the U.S. Green Building Council, which is an NGO. She is working with companies, with NGOs, with other cities to really come up with standards for sustainable neighborhoods. What would a sustainable neighborhood look like, you know, in terms of and so forth? And I thought, this is what an interesting marriage, you know, of for-profit, non-profit, and government, you know, to your point again, that's occurring. So you see these new hybrid associations of people coming together to work on these issues. Yes?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate this. I actually bring greetings from
John. I'm sorry, could I just ask you to give your name?
Sure. My name's Brian Goodman. I'm actually from the city of Boston, so I hope to address maybe a government perspective on this. I actually bring greetings from John Raymer in Seattle, and I have a question and hopefully an announcement. The question is around the role that you think youth are likely to play in kind of this coming revolution, given their increased awareness and their increased comfort with connectivity and kind of dispersed networks. And then the second thing is, I just wanted to announce this because you guys have played a big role in this. We've launched something in here in Boston called Boston Community Change, which is an effort to take some of the principles of connecting multiple constituents. It's a program that works around regenerative commerce to encourage people to shop locally in our neighborhoods, and when they do so, their dollars are actually supporting local schools and nonprofits and the causes that keep their community strong. So it's a way to say, look, we think we're the city, we're the top down. We want to partner with the bottom up and to empower local residents to vote with their dollars here in the neighborhoods here in Boston. So if you're interested in this, talk with me and Paul and the Natural Capital Institute have been great supporters with us here in Boston to make this happen.
Thanks, Brian. I think that really is illustrative of, because we oftentimes when we think of this movement, we think of resistance, or and there is a part of it that very much wants to prevent harm. To go back to the immune system, I mean, what the movement identifies is humane, humane, not humane. Just like the immune system is human, human, not me, you know, out it goes, human, not me, me, not me. This is humane, not humane. And if it's not humane, it definitely does something to try to prevent further damage and harm. But at the same time, and I think Brian makes a really good point here, and that is what we don't see is the amazing amount of innovation and ideas that's going on. This movement is not ideological, it's about ideas. And ideas are wonderful because if they work, you use them. If they don't, you toss them and try a new one. And that really is how things evolve. And you're seeing a rapid turnover and trying out of innovation and ideas in this movement. And again, that's another area that I think that is not seen, because when we hear about this movement in the media, it's because somebody got their head, you know, bashed in, there's been a demonstration, there's some razor wire, some people are meeting behind closed doors, you know, and there's people protesting, and that makes good copy. But it's really the tiniest, tiniest fraction of this movement. And the innovation that Boston is doing here is really extraordinary, and that is really, and it's happening again all over the world, which is people are realizing that given the long supply lines, peak oil, and other conditions, that we have to start thinking locally and regionally again, and building resilient systems for food, for transport, for energy, for water, and stop importing our lives, you know, really. from and start recreating the things that we love so much, which is really people and relationships and celebrations and salsa and dance and good food and singing and all the things that really make us human instead of inhuman.
My name's Ryan Buckley. But my question is actually kind of a follow-up to that. I was trying to remember the Emerson that I read in high school. If I remember correctly, one of his ideas was that things can be built up, but you have to accept that eventually anything that's built is going to fall, and that like the fundamental unit of the universe is the idea. And you talked a lot about networks and how strong and resilient networks are. My question is, will networks eventually break down? And in your investigation of the environmental movement and the way this is organically springing up all over the world, like what's the end game like? Or is there a potential downside to like a breakdown in the network? Is that possible?
There was an interesting thing that came up. Remember Y2K? And there was two schools, and one school was stock up, buy your generators now, right? And the other school was yeah, and the yeah school was right. And the reason they were right is because the assumption about Y2K was that the system would come to a grinding halt; it would break. And the reason it didn't break is because it's breaking all the time. That was what they missed: is that the thing isn't that well built in the first place. It's always falling apart. And so the amazing thing about this movement is that it's already atomized. It's already completely divided. And so the only way it can go actually is to start to connect up. You compare that to ideologies, and they're the opposite, which is that they're constantly falling apart. You know, people trying to hold the center, and of course, as we're reminded by, it's the center does not hold, you know, is what Emerson was saying too. You know, it will never hold. Because it's held together by what? You know, force. And that force is not maintainable or sustainable. And so every ism becomes a schism. But this is not an ism, and therefore it can't be schismatic, you know. And so the networks will rise and fail all the time. They're doing it all the time. And that really is much more of what we see in living systems as opposed to the more rigid or inorganic sort of fantasies that we have about order and institutions and the way things ought to be and all that sort of stuff. And that way, this movement is much more resonant and supple and pliable with respect to its environment and can change on a dime. You know? But I don't try to make too many predictions about the future. There's one thing I did learn recently, though, which I think is very important. I have a friend who's a Russian Jew, and he did his DNA, and it came back, and he was Italian. And a lot Italian. And so he went to his mom and said, excuse me, but here's the LLs. And she said, oh, you know, we don't talk about that, you know. And... And it was really great. So I had my DNA done. And we know we're Irish, Scottish, Swedish, French, and Cornish. I mean, no question about it. Ethan Allen. You know, we can go down. Our forebears. Da, 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 da. And I came back Swiss, Portuguese, Spanish, Italian, and Flemish. And, and immediately I felt like I didn't have to be an uptight Nordic guy. You know? I was like... hey, I'm hot, you know? It's like, whoa, my hips moved better. Everything was different. And I realized, you know, we have these strange mental models in us crawling around about who we are. And these models separate us from each other. And what is so extraordinary about what will happen, and this is a prediction, and that is that it will bring us together or we will really fail. Because when somebody is hurt alongside of the road, you do not ask who they voted for or what religion they are. Your whole being goes to wanting to help this person. It's number one. And, you know, I have met people or seen people who are enemies on the broken levee during a flood, and they didn't care anymore about that thing. They carried cared about the levee and the sandbags. And I feel like, in to respect to the IPCC and climate, I mean, we are going to become homeless in this century. And what I mean by that is we can be in the same house, but the flora and the fauna and the weather and the patterns, everything will change. That is done. That is the fait accompli. Now, whether we can turn it around by 2050 or 2060 or something remains to be seen. But before we get there, nothing we know as home will be the same. And we will all become homeless in some way or another. And the question is, who will we be? Who will we become? Are we preparing ourselves to be each other's brothers and sisters, to be the kind of neighbors and friends and communities that we long for, or are we doing something else? You know, and I feel that we're in a practice zone right now. This is the time to rehearse. This is the time for us to learn and to figure out exactly who we want to be. I think the reason we esteem and honor the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan community so much is because they were literally deracinated and thrown out of their home, and they never, ever, ever sought vengeance, never. And they became better people for it, not worse, and so forth. And the question is, how will we respond to what we have created? We did this, no one else. And who will we be to each other?
So Paul, if there's no ideology, what are the values of this movement?
Well, there's an interesting set of values, and I can't remember them all right now, but there's the universals, and then there's these values which are common to every culture in the world. And my road rat book tour short-term memory is failing right now, or I would rattle them off for you, but you can look them up on the internet. But there are values that we hold in common everywhere in the world, and so you don't need an ideology to care about children, about parents, about, you know, the things that are sort of inarguable. It doesn't mean there's not pathological people in the world. I'm just saying, but those aren't values. Those are actions, you know. There's one more question.
Hello. My name's Kevin Hoyle, and I'm a student of biology and of computer science, designing self-organizing systems.
You are.
So I find your talk very inspiring. I believe that it is possible for these systems to have a dynamic which organizes them towards a certain end without central control. But I don't think that settles the issue, because I think that's also happening in economic systems. I think that we have a system which is directed by nobody, which creates advertising designed to neuter our social sense, which makes us comfortable with deciding to drive a car and endangering our future. So I'm interested to know what makes you think that the kind of self-organizing principle that you describe, which I hope does exist and I hope will succeed, but how is it going to win that battle against another very effective self-organizing principle as outlined by Malthus and Smith?
Excellent question. And I'm not predicting success or failure. What I do try to do is describe what I see, and it's slightly different. Having said that, I mean, a self-organizing system has simple rules, good communication, and quick feedback loops. I mean, and you put those three together, and you'll get a self-organizing system. I'm oversimplifying, but for the sake of brevity, and you do see that in economics or the economy. But let's go back to the last one, which is the feedback loops, which is real feedback loops, and not just Madison Avenue and not how many units or SKUs were bought at Walmart last night, but really oil, water, air, soil. I mean, these are feedback loops as well. So what we are facing, what we're seeing, is an economy that has famously pretended that there are no limits and starting to encounter and run into them. And how it will then incorporate those feedback loops and change, of course, is anybody's guess. But I suspect that it'll be like John Doerr, who is one of the more famous venture capitalists and who some years ago said, listen, the future is in molecules, not in bytes. I mean, that's been done. And what the world needs is more and better molecules. And what he's talking about is clothing and wood and fiber and health, and housing and healthcare. And he said that's where the future lies. And I feel like a lot of people are recognizing that the future of commerce, which can go either way, really lies in serving its customers, truly in the new context in which the limits are protracted and extreme in some cases, and is going to require an amazing amount of innovation and creativity and inventiveness. And at this, business is very, very good. I mean, in gathering the people and the designers and the engineers and so forth to create amazing systems of innovation and laboratories of that. So I don't want to sound like I'm pro-business or anti-business. I mean, it's just, I hope I haven't done that. I'm definitely anti-corruption and the looseness of money. But in terms of business, it is an amazing seed of innovation, and it will be a huge ally to us if it actually reads the feedback loops correctly. Thank you, Kevin.
Hi, my name's Aditya Nochur, and I was just wondering your thoughts on spaces like the World Social Forum, where the kinds of organizations you're talking about come together from all over the world, organizations that normally might be working together separately without any conception of each other. So your thoughts on those kinds of forums and what sort of transformative potential, if any, you see in those kinds of spaces?
Well, I've attended them. They're not like Davos. They arose originally in response to the World Economic Forum in Davos, and the World Social Forum was a response. The first one was in Porto Alegre. I think the first three were in Porto Alegre, and then they went to Mumbai and Nairobi, and I think there's a small one in Atlanta coming up. And they're amazing places. I mean, if you're a voyeur, it's the best place in the world in terms of voyeur of social movements. I mean, and to go from classroom to classroom to classroom and just listen. And the what I was trying to, you know, show on that video, you get the first of all the diversity of the organizations, the intensity and the fierceness with which they are addressing problems, the innovation, the care, the chaos, the underfundedness, the lack of resources, the need to connect and to find ways to work better. I mean, it's a laboratory. It can be seen critically, I think, by well-established, well-funded organizations as being disorganized, as being not professional. But I think because it's incipient and growing and emerging so quickly, I think it is can be understood that it is organized in the way it is or disorganized in the way it is at this time. Anyway, it's a great experience.
So it looks like the hour has arrived. As a matter of fact, here.
They want us to do. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I'll just take a moment to thank you, Paul, for your amazing ideas here, for holding up a mirror to almost everyone who came here tonight, because what you're doing really counts. What you're doing really counts, even if it seems that that rock keeps rolling right back down the hill again once you take it up to the top. It really counts. So thank you so much for coming tonight.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.